This episode is brought to you by the American Homebrewers Association, a passionate and diverse group of individuals committed to the art, science, and community of beer. You can join them at homebrewersassociation.org. That's homebrewersassociation.org. Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, September 26th, 2019. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Aaron Mayer, distiller at Pine Bluffs Distilling in Pine Bluffs, Wyoming, tells us what it's like to brew for distilling. He also introduces us to Wyoming Malting Company, which turns local Wyoming grain into the malt that Aaron uses to brew up his tasty spirits. If you go to basicbrewing.com, you can find archives of our audio and video shows, and if you go to basicbrewingshop.com, you can find our DVDs, our brewers' logbooks, and other Basic Brewing gear. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Basic Brewing and find our show page on Facebook as well. We have a cool Basic Brewing app on iTunes and Amazon.com, and we're found all over the place where fine podcasts are served up. If you do us the favor of rating us on iTunes and maybe leaving a nice comment, that will help new listeners to find us and boost our egos, which is always important. If you want to support us financially, check out patreon.com/basicbrewing. And thanks to everybody who's helping out. If you go to patreon.com/basicbrewing, you can see a long list of stuff that you can access if you sign up as a supporter. I'm planning to release a video episode this Friday featuring my two-hearted ale clone fermented at 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 C on my porch with Oslo yeast from Bootleg Biology. We like the Pilsner that I fermented hot with Oslo. How will it handle the hops? Financial supporters of Basic Brewing have already had an opportunity to see that episode and the recipe, and upper tier supporters have access to a behind-the-scenes episode that the general public won't see. And thanks again to everybody who's chipped in to support the show. And speaking of those who support Basic Brewing, this episode is brought to you by Brewers Publications, whose collection of books on beer and brewing will elevate the quality of your beer and deepen your appreciation of the brewer's craft. Browse the complete Brewers Publications catalog at brewerspublications.com. That's brewerspublications.com. And I definitely appreciate the AHA and Brewers Publications for supporting the show. I have an amazing library of brewing knowledge that is mainly from Brewers Publications. So I've learned so much as a brewer because of them and the authors that work with them. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Listener Ken writes after hearing last week's show. Ken says, I've been wanting to try and make a banana chocolate stout. When I listened to the Hop Sampler podcast, it set my wheels spinning. Do you think the Yarilo hop would play well in a lactose stout? I'd love for the banana to really come through and might even split a batch to age on actual bananas. What do you think? Wow. That sounds tasty. It sounds like a fun beer. I appreciate that, Ken. I wrote back to Ken saying that if it were me, I'd keep the roasted character fairly muted, you know, to pair with the Yarilo. But then I realized he's going to be using lactose, so the sweetness is probably going to tone the roastiness down already. I wonder what Hefeweizen yeast would do in this brew. Would that ramp up the banana character as well? I've had dark Hefeweizens. They were almost like, sipping liquid banana bread, and they were delicious. I've never brewed with actual bananas, but now my mental wheels are spinning as well. If you've brewed with a similar beer, drop me a line and let me know. You might go bananas over that kind of beer. Hey, late-breaking big news from our friends and sponsors, Desiree and Dave from High Gravity in Tulsa. I told you last week they're celebrating their 15th anniversary. Well, you can join in the celebration because until the end of September, High Gravity is offering 15% off Werthog electric brewing systems and controllers. High Gravity's been making electric systems for more than a decade. They have Werthog systems from 5 gallons all the way up to 2 barrels. And you can get yours until the end of the month for 15% off. That's a heck of a deal. I have a Werthog system for my gravity, and it's changed the way I brew for the better. Whether you're a single-vessel brew and a bag brewer like me, or a more traditional two- or three-vessel brewer, High Gravity Brew has something to make you happy, and until the end of the month, you can save 15% off your Warthog system or controller purchase. No promo code needed. Get geared up for the brewing season for 15% off Warthog systems and controllers at family-owned and operated HighGravityBrew.com. That's HighGravityBrew.com. 15% off! Okay, a while back, Aaron Mayer wrote me to suggest it would be fun to talk about his job as a distiller. And even though distilling goes beyond the usual boundaries of the show, Aaron is still a brewer. It's just that the beer that he makes is not the final product. Aaron Mayer, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you for having me, James.
Now, we're getting into an area that's a little bit off the beaten path. You are a distiller, and we are all about brewing. And we have to say that distilling at home is still illegal in the United States. So, you know, we have to tread kind of carefully. But as you wrote me in an email of introduction, you are still a brewer.
I still make 500 gallons of beer every single day, believe it or not, working at a distillery.
And it's just what you do with that beer afterwards is the is what sets you apart from, say, craft brewers.
True.
So first of all, tell me about your background. How did you get into brewing? How long have you been into brewing? And kind of talk about your path.
Well, my path started out, I guess it started out when I was probably about 10 years old. My dad got the old, and this is in the 80s, so as you could probably remember, home brewing supplies in the 80s consisted of pretty much a can of John Bull hop extract with a packet of yeast taped to the top of the can. And my dad brewed in the basement. So I would help my dad brew, and I can remember holding the bottles and the bottling machine and him pressing the caps on. And I just did that just as a thing to, you know, help my dad out and be with him hanging out. When I was 18, after I graduated from high school, I joined the Air Force. While I was in North Dakota, Grand Forks, they had this liquor store called Happy Harry's. And it had a homebrew section in it. And I wanted to start brewing. I lived in the dorms. And I don't know if you've been to North Dakota, but between the months of probably October and May, there's not much to do outside because the temperature is 20 below. Yeah, I started brewing in the dorms. Got the Charlie's book, Complete Joy of Home Brewing, and kind of dove in. And I spent probably about 2 years during that time where I didn't buy any beer myself. I just brewed it. And that's where I really got hooked on the process. The process of brewing is a good combination of science mixed with artistry. So you have the science where you still have to meet your temperatures and hit all that stuff to get the product to turn out right. But then there's quite a bit of artistry, too, with how you express yourself with, the hops you add and where you add them and so on and so forth. So that's where I really geeked out. I retired in 2012. Since that time, I'd gone to California, was stationed there for about 9 years, and then I moved to Wyoming, to Cheyenne, Wyoming, and finished out my career. I spent my last 5 years of my career in the Air Force in Cheyenne. And that's where I really jumped into it, and I kind of went from an extract brewer mainly to an all-grain brewer. So I kind of immersed myself into brewing, and I did a lot of – kind of put myself through school. At that time, I was working as a side job as a bartender at a local brewery in Cheyenne. And they would let me brew every now and then on their small – they had a 10-gallon pilot system. Them and I would brew firkins for them, and we'd do a firkin night on like Thursday night. So I got to know some brewers around the area, did some helping on big brewing systems, and kind of learned how to work a tri-clam, how to move hoses around from here to here. And then there was a new brewery that was opening up in Cheyenne, and I applied. I got to know the owners. I applied there, and they hired me as their brewer. And it was a small brewery. It was 7 barrels. We had 3 fermenters, and 8 taps I had to fill. During that time, I'd met some people around the area that were starting up a malting company. It piqued my curiosity. So since I was into brewing and everything, I really got to talking to them and saying, yeah, that's pretty cool. We're making malts right in the area. And it's going to be a local thing. That's a pretty cool thing. He said, yeah, this is what we're doing. We're hoping to get it up and moving within the next couple of years. This is in 2015. And he said, at the same time, we're also going to open up a distillery. Because if you make malt, malt is cheap. So if you have a lot of malt around, doing a distillery is a very easy and cheap thing to do.
So you had to extend your knowledge. Now you had to go from being a brewer to taking the brewing to one more step.
And that's what I was worried about. As they were opening, they had one of the owners of the company, his sister, was going to be the distiller. And they sent her to Moonshine University in Louisiana. And she got educated on all the distilling stuff. But, things happen, life progresses. And then they started getting busy. So I wasn't real happy with where I was at the brewery just because of other, outside circumstances. I wasn't very happy. I was looking to move. They were looking at a new person to help in the distillery with maybe the consideration of in the future opening a brewery as well. So it would be nice to have a brewer, a professional brewer on staff. And the owners were very good at recognizing the fact that that brewing and distilling are very similar. I mean, you got to do one to do the other.
Mm-hmm.
So I was brought on in November of last year in 18, and I spent the entire winter making a lot of whiskey. We have the capability of making a barrel of whiskey a day, so 50 gallons a day is what we're cranking out. And we spent, me and John, the head distiller at the time, we spent all summer, or I'm sorry, all making a ton of whiskey. And that was really my schooling for the distilling side of it. And the brewing side of it was really easy. That wasn't really a problem for me at all, because it's very similar to brewing in a brewery. And actually, it's easier because you don't have to louder. Fermentation isn't as stringent, I should say, for the distilling side. It's still important, but it's not as bad because you're done fermenting within 3 days. So there's really not a chance for anything to take a hold. So, but yeah, I learned the still, learned how to operate the still, and started making whiskey. And then come to find out in the spring of this year, the previous distiller and her husband, she got another job in Pennsylvania. So they moved in June, and guess who got promoted to the distiller job? So they were, I'm lucky enough that they trusted me enough that they were able to move me up to the head distiller position where I was since the first part of the summer, since June.
Well, congratulations. I like to say when you're starting out doing something, you should take advantage of every opportunity to learn that you can, because you never know where life might lead you. So tell me about your company. It's Wyoming Malting Company and then Pine Bluffs Distilling, and they're owned by the same folks. And the company philosophy, according to the website, is basically keeping the product as local as possible. I mean, you guys work with farmers that are just within a small area around your business.
Yes. So we like to say we know all of our farmers by first name. We don't grow any of the grain ourselves, but the grain is grown. Some of it is grown within eyeshot of the distillery. We get all of our grain comes from about 10 or 15 miles, maybe 20 miles from around the distillery. Now, we're located in Pine Bluffs, Wyoming, which is in the southeast corner of the state. We're right on the border of Colorado and Nebraska and Wyoming. In fact, I think Nebraska is about a half mile from the distillery here. So we started out here because there's a lot of barley out here. There's a lot of corn grown out here. So, but it's different corn and barley that you would want to use in the brewing process. It's called feed barley. So they want a lot of protein in it. We don't want a lot of protein in it because that's bad for brewing. So they got the whole thing going. The malting side opened up in 15, and they started malting, working with the farmers and getting all the grain in. We started with barley. We've got two kinds of barley that we use, Odyssey and Genie, and those are fairly common.
I know that you're on the distilling side, but talk about the process. When you get grain coming in from the farmers, what happens to it?
So we just had harvest here within the past, I'd say, 2-3 weeks ago. So the farmers will pick it from the field. And we actually have to talk to the farmers and tell them how we want them to grow it, how we want them to water it. Because if it were up to the farmers, they're going to water the crap out of it, and they're going to make it grow as much as they can. And they're going to get a lot of protein into grain because most of that's going to be fed to cows or hogs. But we don't want protein in our malt because a lot of protein leads to haze and beers, and we don't want that. So we actually had to talk with the local farmers and kind of give them instructions on how to grow malting barley because it's different than feed barley. So once it's harvested, we have outside, we have 8 silos that we will bring it in. The farmers will dump it in those silos, and we'll store it there for until we need it. Once we need it, we'll bring it inside the building, and from there we'll clean it. We'll run it through our big shaker table, and that what that does is gets all the mice and cockroaches and rocks and whatever else out of it because it's coming directly from the field. So we'll clean it through our cleaner shaker table, and then the malting side will take that and they will move that over to their side. And they'll start the malting process, which is a process of soaking that grain in water to get the moisture content in the grain up. Once it's done soaking up, I don't know how in depth you want me to go. To go pretty deep, but the process of soaking it is basically when you plant a seed in the ground, the first thing you do is after you plant it is you water it, and that's what we're doing in that steep tank is we're taking in water, getting it ready to start growing and germinating. Once it's taken up enough moisture, the guys will move it over to our malting drums, which is kind of like a mash tun on its side, so to speak. So think of a big, oh, probably 10 or 15 foot high drum that's probably 15 to 20 feet long. And it's on its side, and on the bottom of that, it has a false bottom on it. It's probably about, I don't know, a quarter of the way up from the bottom of the drum. They'll move all that grain over to that drum, and they're going to blow a specific temperature and a specific humidity air across that grain. And what we're trying to do there is we're mimicking soil conditions. So each grain is going to germinate at a different temperature and a different humidity from the other. So barley is different than what corn would be. So we're going to blow that air across there, and the grain is thinking in itself that, hey, it's time to start growing. It's time to start growing roots and everything. Well, in that process of growing, that grain is it's developing enzymes in it, which are very important in the brewing process. Because those enzymes are used to convert all the starches that are in the grain into sugar. Sugar is very important in the brewing process because when you feed sugar to yeast, it does two things. It makes CO2 and alcohol. So developing all those enzymes that are going to convert all those starches. That is done over a couple days, I would say. I think it's maybe about 3 to 4 days. So once that's done, it's off to the kiln, and it's the same drum, and all they do is they turn up the temperature on it, and they just roast it, similar to what a coffee roaster would do.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference being there's some stewing steps if you want to stew and make a Munich-type malt as opposed to a base as opposed to a crystal malt or caramel malt. There's some different steps. You have to stew it and develop the Maillard reactions, depending on the type of grain that we're making, so or malt, I should say, that we're making. And that process of drying and kilning takes a couple days also. So by the time it enters our facility for malting, it's out of there within 6 or 7 days, and it's ready to be used at that point.
Now, since you're the brewer and the distiller, you get to specify what mm-hmm. you want. Now, do you in brewing for distilling, do you still want, say, a crystal malt or something like that, or some kind of specialty malt, or are you sticking with just a base malt that's got the highest enzymatic power possible?
The short answer to that is yes. So it's a combination of everything. So and that's the biggest thing that I actually learned when I moved out to the distilling side is that that roasted flavor from the grain really makes its way through the still. You can definitely taste crystal malt in the final whiskey that we're making. So yes, we have some limitations on the malting side of how the kind of malt that we can make, meaning we can only go up to about, like, our highest kiln we have now is a 60 Lovibond, and that's, we could probably go to 100 because there's some temperature limitations in our drum. We have to get up around the 350 range, and that's, we can't go that high in our malting drums. You actually have to bring in a coffee roaster to get some of that chocolate malt and the roasted barley and kind of malt because it's such a high temperature that it's roasted at. So we have pale malt, we have Pilsner malt, we have Vienna, we have Munich 10, Munich 20, we have Caramel 45, we have Caramel 60, and that's what we have in barley. Now we also do wheat and rye. We malt both of those too, which is interesting too, because it's cool because we get to do a lot of cool experiments. Like, hey, you know, let's make a 100% wheat whiskey and let's make that wheat a Munich 15. I mean, wow. I don't know anybody out there that's making a Munich 15 wheat. So it's pretty cool that I have my own personal private malter to say, hey, I want to try to make a weird whiskey that can you make me this malt? And yeah, you know, he'll make me 2,000 pounds of it and just to see if it'll work. So I'm very spoiled that way.
So talk about once the malt is made and it comes over to you, does your brewing setup look like, would it look familiar to anybody who's been in a craft brewery?
Yes, it would. So we have a mash tun and four fermenters, and then we have two different stills. So it looks similar, but it's a little different. So my process would start when I come in on a day. I get the mash tun heated up. I already usually have my strike water fairly close to temperature, but I get my water set to the right temperature, and I turn on our mill and I start milling grains. The big difference is we mill it to almost a powder consistency because I'm not worried about a louder. In fact, my mash tun, it's not your typical looking mash tun. It doesn't even have a false bottom on it. It's just a big fermenter is what it kind of looks like. But it's steam jacketed, and then it's also glycol jacketed as well. So I'll come in and I'll heat up my strike water. I'll start moving my grain over and I'll start mashing. And I usually mash around 160 and just get a more efficient mash. And I'll let that go for about an hour. sometimes the mashes are a little different depending on what we're making. For instance, if we're doing bourbon, the corn that we use is not malted. So for the corn, we have to do a cereal mash.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of cool. With steam and glycol, it's really lucky because it's really easy to move the temperatures up and down to get the different steps that I need to go through for cereal mashing. And, you know, even cereal mashing corn is a different temperature than cereal mashing oats or barley or those other ones. So depending on what my recipe would be, but it's very similar to what's happening in I mash, I let it sit for an hour or so, I cool that down, I add my yeast to it, I'll add a little bit of enzyme to make sure that I'm getting a full conversion and that I'm going to ferment completely out to zero. So, and then I move it to the fermenters, and I get into the fermenter about, I don't know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And by the time I'm leaving work at about 5 o'clock or so, that thing is rocking and rolling. It's that yeast, the distiller's yeast is a rocket ship compared to what brewer's yeast is.
So, and this is all, the whole mash goes in the fermenter.
Yes, that's why I say it's a little bit easier working in a distillery because I don't have to worry about an hour-long sparge. I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm getting grain and it's going to be astringent because I'm not boiling it. So it goes directly from the mash tun. Once I do my mash temperatures, whatever I'm mashing temperature at, I'll cool it down. Once it gets to about 90 degrees Fahrenheit, I'll move it over to the fermenter, put yeast in it, and it's going.
So you don't do a boil, but do you do some sort of a mash out step? It's a 170 or something like that to do any kind of pasteurization, or does that not matter?
No. Well, I guess it would be pasteurized. 160 for an hour would be considered pasteurized, wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I can't remember what the rules are on that. So yeah, it would be pasteurized. And, you know, during that time, I am concerned about making sure I'm sanitized. I mean, we still sanitize our hoses. I sanitize the tank I go into. I still do an acid wash. I still do a PW wash on all of our tanks. So all that is very, very similar to the brewing process. It's just that it just goes so quick, and there's no boil, no hops. And the beer, you know, technically I am making beer, but it's not necessarily beer that you want to drink. So there's a reason why you add hops to beer. It's a nice balance to whether you're a hophead or not, but you got to have hops in there. There's a reason for it. I don't know if you've had any unhopped beer, but it's not very good when it's finished.
Well, I made the latest video episode that I posted as of this recording today. I did a Sati, which is an unhopped beer, but the yeast, the Kvike yeast that I used really brought a lot of character to it that was, you know, tropical fruits and things like that. And it was almost like having hops in it. So I guess it depends on what you're making.
I've got an interesting side note on that Kvike yeast. We've been actually toying around with that out here. It's kind of taken the whole brewing world by storm. I think it's going to revolutionize the brewing industry as far as yeast production goes, because of the properties.
Yeah, I mean, if you're fermenting at 90 degrees Fahrenheit, that's what I fermented this Sati at, you know, on my porch here in Arkansas. And it got done in a couple of days, you know, with a 10% beer. So who knows where Kvike will lead us.
The pitch rates for that Kvike are they're not as the same as the pitch rates what for a normal beer would be. From the research I've done, I could ferment a 500 gallons of distiller's beer with about the same pitch that you would use for like a 5 gallon batch.
Wow.
So it doesn't take much. And it's, we've actually thought about just doing some cost saving stuff, for our yeast that maybe we should just start buying packets of that Kvike yeast. I'm sorry, I'm butchering the pronunciation, but we're actually considering using some of that because it's a little bit cheaper than what our distiller's yeast would be. So, but yeah, that's something we were just toying around with. So,
well, I know Steve sells distiller's yeast. And I'm sure that the people who buy it aren't breaking the law in any way, but they're big old packages. I mean, they're big old packages of yeast.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we go through a yeast company, Kentucky, that's actually, they started with a Nutri-Grain spirit for like ethanol production. So it's pretty interesting.
Hmm. So when you, after your fermentation, you've got this beer, and you say it's not necessarily quaffable, but what does it taste like?
Well, it's different depending on what we're doing. Over the winter, we did a couple of interesting different things. We did what we call a Munich whiskey, to where our grain bill was some Pilsner malt, some Munich 10, and then that's it. And believe it or not, that Munich really, really comes through. So you could actually taste that roastedness. We had an interesting project we did with a brewery around here to where they took some of our barrels that we just dumped some of our rye whiskey out of, and they made an imperial brown, and they in those barrels. They dumped the barrels. They didn't want them anymore. We took them back to us, and we asked them, and we said, hey, what's the grain bill that you used on that beer? So they gave us the grain bill, and we mimicked it in the distillery. We made the same grain bill, and we made what we call a brown whiskey, and we distilled it, and we put it back in those barrels. So it's a kind of a cool project. It's like a complete life cycle, I guess.
Huh.
So, and you can really taste the difference of those malts in there. We actually made what we call a stout whiskey, because we made a stout beer. It had chocolate malt in it. It had Crystal 60. It had some Munich and some base pills, or some base pale malt. And you could taste that roast all the way through the still, which really surprises me. I thought that still would lose all those nuances of the roasted malt, but it's definitely there.
Huh. Now, you don't get the color of the malt, right?
Of course not, yeah. When everything that comes off the still is crystal clear, it looks like water.
And of course, I guess if you distilled it, two or three times, you'd probably, would you lose even the flavor character?
Yes, and that's something that we actually have two different stills. We have what we call a stripping still and then a spirit still. So once we're done with fermentation, we'll move that entire vessel into the stripping still. And it's about 500 gallons of about a 10% beer is what it ends up being. We'll move that directly from the fermenters into the still, and we'll turn that still on. And we don't care what tastes like coming off that still. We're just, our main concern is removing alcohol from the beer. So that we'll go through and run the complete batch. And then we'll take that, the runnings from that, which we call low wines. We'll take that and we'll put it in our spirit still, which is really where we start to care about how it tastes. So we have three different columns. Two of our columns have 10 plates each, and then one of our columns has 4 plates each. So when we're making vodka, we'll use two of the columns with 10 plates each, and we'll run it through that one, because vodka is not supposed to taste like anything. Vodka is supposed to be flavorless and tasteless and not very good.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my thing about vodka. So yes, we do run it through those plates, because each one of those columns that has all those different plates on it, each plate is a distillation, which removes flavor and makes alcohol more pure. For our bourbons, you want to taste flavor. You want to taste the grain. You want to taste the corn. So in that case, we'll use our smaller column plates in that. And I actually have the capability to turn off one or some of the plates. So we're actually only using two of those plates in there. So that way, that flavor of that that grain that we're getting in the beer does come through quite significantly.
Now that we're into the distilling process, I have a question. You may have the opportunity to either confirm or bust a myth.
Okay.
And that is, if you distill something improperly, you can cause brain damage and you can cause people to go blind.
Absolutely. That's not a myth at all. That's back in the days of Prohibition in the Dark Ages, people were making bathtub gin and a lot of them were going blind because they had no clue what heads, hearts, and tails were. So the simple breakdown is heads is where all your methyl alcohol comes off of, and that's the stuff that's bad for you. Mm. That's the stuff that make you go blind. That's the stuff that'll eventually kill you in enough concentration. So that's very, very dangerous thing we have to do. So in our first run, our stripping still, we don't separate the heads, hearts, and tails. We just put all the alcohol into one container. And then from there, we will, when we go to the spirit still, our collection tank we have actually is separated into two different sides. So we have a heads and a tail side, and then a heart side. So heads and the tails, meaning the stuff that comes off the still at the very first thing is the bad alcohol. That's your methyl alcohol. That'll go in one tank. And then once we're satisfied that all that bad alcohol is off of it, we'll move the tube over to the collection tank, and that's where the hearts are at. That's where your good tasting alcohol is. And then that'll run until it gets to the tails, which are, it's not dangerous, it just doesn't taste good. Mm. And it's not very high in alcohol content, so we'll move that over and turn the still off. So yes, it will definitely hurt you.
Mm. And I guess that's one of the main reasons why home distilling is still illegal. And also taxes. The government likes its taxes.
Well, the man wants his money. I think that's more reason why distillation is illegal at home. But yes, it's dangerous. It doesn't necessarily get dangerous because if you think about it, when you drink a beer, normal day-to-day beer, that methyl alcohol in it.
Mm.
But the problem becomes when you distill something, what you're doing is you're concentrating that. So when you're concentrating all that methyl alcohol, that's where it gets very dangerous. So on a normal day-to-day basis, when you're drinking regular beer, it has methyl alcohol in it, but the rates are so low that it doesn't even affect you. So it's not like the still generates this stuff. It's always existing in the alcohol. And if you're going to, we're making 500 gallons. We let the still run for, I don't know, 15 minutes or so to get all the heads off of it. And it's, you could definitely tell the hearts and the heads. It's, the heads just taste horrible.
Mm.
And it burns and it's bad. It's very easy to tell which is which. If you're doing it on a beer, there might be, I don't know, a couple milliliters, and I'm just guessing here. I don't know the actual numbers on it, but there's not very much bad alcohol in that. So that's why when it comes to distillation, it's concentrating all that alcohol together, and that's where it gets dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that bad alcohol? Is it waste, or is it a product that you can sell somewhere else?
You can. And a lot of big distilleries, the big companies out there, they are making use of that. But we do use it. We have a guy in town that has a fabrication shop to where he makes all kinds of metal stuff. And he'll come over every once in a while and grab a 5-gallon bucket of it, and he uses it to clean off his metal when he's getting ready to clean to weld on stuff. So it is a good cleaner. It does work well on shower doors. It cleans the glass very well. I know that from personal experience. But for the most part, it's waste. I mean, and we're making probably, I say we let the still run for 15 minutes. That equals probably about 5 gallons, maybe 10 gallons of alcohol. And it's about, it's high alcohol. It's between, if we're making vodka, it's 190 proof. And if we're making whiskey, it's going to start out about 180. So
wow. It's
high proof, yeah.
And to get the proof, you double the percentage of alcohol. So 50% alcohol would be 100 proof,
true.
Right?
True. Yes. So it goes all the way up to 200. To get the still to run at 200 is nearly impossible. I'm going to say it's impossible on our still because it's very hard to get it to run at 190. So there's a lot of tinkering you got to do with it. So it's very hard to get it to run at that high alcohol output.
So once you get this clear spirit, if you're doing vodka, you're done basically, right? Or you got to water it down.
Yeah. You don't say water it down. You say proofing it down. Because if you say watering it down, it makes it sound like you stretch it out. So we proof it down. So yeah, the rules to vodka, it's got to come off the still at 190 proof. So we'll take, just to give you some numbers here, we'll take 500 gallons of about 10% beer, and we'll run that through our stripping still, and that equals about 125 gallons of around 75 proof alcohol. So we'll do that twice, and we'll fill up our container with about 250 gallons of about 75 proof alcohol. And I'll move that to our spirit still, and turn the spirit still on. If we're making vodka, that 250 gallons of 75 proof alcohol turns into about 30 or 40 gallons of 190 proof vodka. If I'm making whiskey, the rules for whiskey is it has to come off still at 160 proof and below. So for whiskey, it's quite a bit longer. It doesn't have to come off constantly at 160 and below, so we'll start collecting at 160 and I'll let it run all day long until it comes, it probably ends at the end of the day around 100-120 proof maybe. So that equals, from that 250 gallons of 75 proof alcohol, that will turn into 90 to 100 gallons of about 140 proof. For vodka, you're absolutely right, we'll water it down, we'll proof it down to 80 proof, and it's ready for sale. It goes into bottles, and then it's ready to head out the door. For whiskey, it's a little different. If we're making white whiskey, it's very similar to vodka. We take it to proof, whatever we decide it's going to be. It's usually between 90 and 80 proof, and then that'll go into a bottle. We don't do very much white whiskey because we don't be known for brown. But, for brown whiskey, it gets proofed down to 120 proof, and then it goes into a barrel. And then we're filling, right now we're filling 53 gallon barrels, which is standard, the industry standard size for whiskey. But we started off with some 8 gallons, some 15 gallons, some 30 gallon, and 53 gallon barrels. So we've got quite a mixture of stuff, and the reason for the different sizes is the smaller the barrel, the greater surface area of the liquid is actually touching the wood. So it ages quicker in a smaller barrel. And you could do some things to that barrel called, we get some of our barrels are honeycombed, especially in the first couple of years that we started, because, you know, 2-3 years is a long time to wait money back out of that whiskey. So we wanted to accelerate some of that aging time to kind of get some money coming in the door. So we use these smaller barrels. So we can go from, like, if you take a if you honeycomb the barrel, which is just drilling thousands of holes on the inside, which is going to further increase your surface area, which is going to decrease your aging time. So we could take a standard 53-gallon barrel, and which would normally take about 2 years to ripen. We could get a product out of there, a whiskey out of there, within 14 to 18 months. So you're cutting some good amount of time off of there. There are some trade-offs in that process of shortening it. The reason why you let it sit around is, you want that, and this is a good practice, that whiskey to oxidize, and that mellows out the flavor of that alcohol. It doesn't make it as harsh. So you're trading off some time for harshness, maybe. So, but we think it's good coming out of there. We're not going to put something out that's that we don't think is good. So, but our experience has been, it's good right now. So imagine what it's going to be like in 4 years. Mm. So,
well, it's fascinating. You know, I was under the impression, you know, that that distillers were wanting alcohol, and you know, we're going to, you know, get the flavor into it, you know, through filtering or through you know, aging barrels or things like that. And I was unaware that the character of the beer going into the distillation process had such a dramatic effect on the final product.
It does, and that's what surprises me. One of the interesting things I've learned since being out distilling is that the brewing industry has just exploded within the past, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. You know, you started out way back in the day when I first started brewing, a micro beer was Killian's Red.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a unique beer to get at the time. If you didn't want to drink Keystone Lights, you go to the specialty stuff of Keystone, or of, I'm sorry, of this Killian's. So along the distillery, you know, now they have these different breweries that exist on almost every street corner now, and they're all making completely different things, and they're all very handcrafted, and it's pride. The brewers are taking pride in their product because they all know that no one wants to drink, you know, flavorless yellow water all the time. The distilling industry is about 10 or 15 years behind the brewing industry as far as, it's a very same model. There's these big companies, Jim Beam, Jack Daniels, Bulleit, you know, all these huge, huge distilleries that have just owned the market for hundreds of years, basically. Now that the brewing industry has exploded, the craft distilling industry is catching up with that. And there's several distilleries popping up all around the country. I mean, just in Wyoming, you know, our state of only 500,000 people, there's a distillery probably 15 miles from us. There's probably six distilleries all throughout the state. So it's getting bigger and bigger. And what people are learning is you can make a whiskey out of triticale, which I don't know if you're familiar what triticale is, but the farmers grow triticale for hay, and that's what they feed to their cows. But if you let that hay go to seed, you can get a product out of it similar to what a wheat or barley would be. And guess what? You can make whiskey out of it. So we've actually gone even further. We've got oats, rye, wheat, barley, corn. We have some old spelt, like some old as in ancient grains. We've got some spelt and some emmer, which are ancient forms of wheat. It's kind of like an heirloom variety of wheat.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got all these different grains here, and I said, hey, we should make a whiskey with every single grain that we have in the malt house. So let's make a 7-grain whiskey. And no one out there is making a 7-grain whiskey, as far as I could tell. So that's where the expression comes in from what you're talking about. There's a lot that goes into the actual mash that is very similar to brewing, and you can get all those different flavors out of it.
That's amazing. I've learned something new, Aaron, and you've opened my eyes, and now I'm curious. You know, I'm curious to see where the distilling industry goes in the next few years.
Yeah, it's getting very, very big. In fact, as proof of that, they have spirit competitions, which are very similar to what GHB or the distilling industry. And they have categories similar to what the BJCP has there for vodka, for a wheat whiskey, a rye whiskey. They're allowing now, there's variances in there for what's called and for what's grain vodka. So neutral grain vodka is, so Tito's buys bulk grain alcohol off the market, and they don't even have a mash tun, they don't have any of that kind of, still, they buy neutral grain alcohol off the market and they run it through their still, and it just makes very clean, very pure vodka. that's what Absolut's like. That's what Grey Goose is like, you know, all the big makers like that. But when these craft distilleries started popping up, these distilleries, vodka is made out of what's cheap for that person. In Russia, potatoes are cheap. So they make vodka out of potatoes over there. In other parts of the world, barley is cheap, so they make it out of barley. In other places, corn is cheap. So for us, barley and wheat are very cheap, and it's a pretty neutral flavor. So that's what we make our vodka out of. And it has flavor. There's a flavor to it. So there is a learning curve for us as far as getting it out to the market, because some people are expecting Absolut when they taste our vodka. And it doesn't taste like that. Mm. It's got some grain. Or some grain flavors, I should say. We've actually coined the term, it's the whiskey drinker's vodka, because there is some, you know, you can taste some of the malt that's in there.
Well, that's cool. I have a feeling we could talk for another mm-hmm. hour. Listen, Aaron, I've learned a lot, and it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate your taking the time.
Well, thank you very much, James, for your time. I'm a big fan.
Well, thanks again to Aaron. I also have to thank Aaron for sending us a bottle each of his single malt whiskey and his bourbon. And I don't know much about spirits, but we think they're very tasty. In fact, my wife Susan really likes the bourbon, responsibly and in moderation, of course. We're making it last. So I've brewed a small batch extract stout, and I put a few ounces of the bourbon in there at bottling time, and it tastes really good. Aaron also sent me 10 pounds of Vienna malt from the Wyoming Malting Company that I brewed as a smash beer. So I plan to feature those on future BBV episodes. So thanks to everybody up at the Wyoming Malting Company and Pine Bluffs Distilling up in Wyoming. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our mobile-friendly shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody supporting us through our Patreon page. As usual, special goodies are always coming your way. Check that out at patreon.com/basicbrewing. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voice, and we'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.